Welcome to our final reading of the Visiting Writers series for 2012-2013. I have the distinct honor of introducing Tom Slay. I used to keep in my office a framed cover of an issue of Time magazine from 1966. A student of mine had found the magazine in a thrift shop, and I thought I would like to have it because the individual on the cover was one of the poets I most admire, Robert Lowell. Lowell looks grave and a little disheveled in the picture, which is not surprising when you recall that in 1965 and 1966 were the years that he'd been verbally brawling with a very formidable opponent, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Lowell was a figure of such esteem in those days that his refusal to attend a White House reception for the arts as a gesture of protest against the Vietnam War made national headlines. And not long after that, Lowell wrote one of the most important poems of protest in American literature, Waking Early Sunday Morning. Somehow, in one of my various moves, I lost that picture of Lowell. And sometimes I think it's just as well, for when Lowell died in 1977, he may have been the last American poet to be seen as crucial to our culture, our consciousness, to our understanding of what it means to live in this fraught but remarkable republic. Today, people say, maybe with some accuracy, that poetry is a marginal activity, insular, hermetic, kept largely alive by the academy, thanks to that aesthetic dialysis machine we call the creative writing industry. Writers of poetry speak only to themselves about themselves, and although they are clearly devoted to their discipline, even obsessed by it, they seem a lot like folks who attend Star Trek conventions, except for the fact that the Trekkies seem to be having a lot more fun when they get together. I know I've gone on a bit here, and I know that sci-fi references may not be the most appropriate ones to bring up on an occasion such as this, but I think sometimes that Tom Slay lives in an alternate universe. One of the reasons why I admire Tom as much as just about anybody writing poetry today is because he has the deeply felt conviction that the poet still plays an essential role in our culture. He knows that poetry must not debase itself into a mere language game, that it instead demands the hardest self-reckonings, the most ardent command of the craft, and the most profound engagements with politics and history. But he also knows that confronting the intricacies and contradictions of contemporary culture is a dirty and bewildering business. For him, it involves everything from watching a Lebanese militiaman trying to fix a broken French tank, to describing a Soviet-era spacesuit filled with rags and set floating out into the ionosphere, to peering at a grainy YouTube video purporting to show the execution of Saddam Hussein, while at the same time thinking of Shakespeare. He knows we live in a time of acoustical din, manifold injustice, and dissonant mashups which a poem set in a crummy hotel calls food, God, death, money, a TV clicker to push the world back and bring it closer. But he knows also that the purpose of poetry is to help us to endure and even transcend all this insensibility, to find what Eliot called a sea mark to lay a course by. Tom Slay is the author of 8 books of poetry and a collection of autobiographical and critical essays. He's won a dizzying number of awards and honors, among them Guggenheim and NEA fellowships, a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award, the $100,000 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Prize, and most recently the John Updike Memorial Prize. He teaches at Hunter College in Brooklyn and New York, and we are immensely fortunate to have him at VCU tonight. Thomas Slay.
I can say truthfully that now I can die and go to heaven happy if I believed in heaven, which, as you all know, I don't. But anyway, the thing I love about being here is I get to see David. And when you come up with somebody, your same generation, you have this kind of double vision of them. You know something about them as a social person. And then you get this incredibly deep and strange intimacy with them as who they are on the page. And year after year, the kind of intimacy that I feel for David and just the endless kind of inventiveness of his poems and how much they mean to me. Well, I sound like I'm introducing him now. But anyway, I'm just deeply grateful to be here with him, and I'm really honored. I also want to say that it's been sensational to be here with Greg Donovan, a wonderful writer. Tom DiDonato drives a slant six Plymouth Valiant, which is the car I learned to drive on. I managed to wreck that car. I will tell Tom about that some other time. Also, Jenny Schmidt's been fantastic, and everyone here throughout the week has just been terrific. The ghost in the room, of course, is Kathy Graber. Unfortunately, some people will do anything to miss a reading, so she broke her wrist. Okay, I'm going to read about, David asked me to read 25, 30 minutes. I want to thank VCU. I've had a great time this week in the workshops. One of the great things about being with the students all week is, at my advanced age, it's always wonderful to be reminded of what it was to be young, particularly a young writer. There's a strange kind of hunger, and to be around that sort of energy again is just very, very, it puts you on your mettle. It lets you know what the stakes are, and the stakes are high. Sincerity is hard to take, I know. I'll just start off with a poem David mentioned. I'll go back and forth between new work and old work. I've been talking a lot in class, so I'm sure you'll be grateful if I just read. So I will do that. Beirut Tank. Staring up into the tank's belly, lit by a bare bulb hanging down off the exhaust, a mechanic's hands are up inside the dark metallic innards, doing something that looks personal, private. This tank is nothing like the ones the Americans deploy. Those have uranium-piercing shields that can melt right through this tank's armor and set off the ammo box. Nothing can withstand the American tanks. The barrel's called a cannon. The machine guns they call deterrents. The tank is old, small, about the size of a horse and cart. The armor plate shines green under the street light. The sprockets almost rusted out. Somebody forgot to grease the nipples. The timing belt is nicked and worn. The spare parts from France don't fit. This wire crossed with this wire makes a catastrophic fire. Be careful how you route it. 20 caliber ammo goes in the hatch behind the armor plate. The mechanic, on his back in the dirt, cursing in Arabic, sounds like he's cursing in a good-natured way. Who was the fucking moron who did the maintenance on this thing? This tank, he should push it off a cliff into the sea to bob for half an hour before sinking under the Pigeon Rocks where all the lovers gather in the shadows near that little bar lit by a generator that serves arak and warm beer to soldiers hanging out on the Corniche. Mainly conscripts from down south whose orange groves rot because nobody can pick the oranges. Try to pick an orange, and a cluster bomb lodged in leaves comes tumbling into your basket. What weight oil did this cocksucker use anyway? And this engine, it's gonna blow. Beat up tanks and sandbags, That's all this army is, old spark plugs that get fouled so that you have to file the gaps over and over. He stares up in that live, minute, completely concentrated way of scrutinizing something or someone you thought you understood. The tank's underbody completely covers his body. They look like they're embracing when he reaches up inside it, his needle nose pliers crimping, twisting, pulling down hard. There, you see that? It's all corroded. The cannon jutting out looks both threatening and vulnerable, as if the tank's firepower were dependent on that wire. He runs two fingers up and down it, then feels where rust, mixed into an oily paste, shines like bloody flux. He gently dips his finger in, sniffs, and tastes. Clanging back is tapping on the armor plate as he listens to her talking on his back in the dirt, screwing in the spare parts. The tank says what tanks always say. Fix me, oil me, grease me, make it fit. Confirming what he knows about the French. I'll read this for Amelia. She has a Frank Zappa poster in her house. Self-portrait with shoulder pads. You know, I played high school football. I'm still recovering. My twin brother and I played, and once the coach asked us to get down on all fours and do a drill in front of the rest of the squad, and we began to smash into each other until he blew the whistle, and we smashed into each other for a long, long time, like probably 3 minutes. That's a long time to be smashing into each other. At any rate, another part of this poem that might help, I don't know if anybody remembers Joe Pyne. He was an old talk show host, one of the very first one. You know, he specialized in humiliating his guests. So you have some guy on, and the guy would have written a book called How to Make a Million, and Joe Pyne, the first thing he would say, well, if you're so rich, how come you have to be on my show? And then it went downhill from there. But there was a very famous exchange between Joe Pyne and Frank Zappa. He had Zappa on the show once. And the last thing you need to know about Joe Pyne is he had a wooden leg. Weird, huh? Self-portrait with shoulder pads. Brother fighting brother and the loser driven out. My eyes were on Tim's eyes, off someplace, gone from his body, while under his jersey the shoulder pads gleam brighter. Masculine yoke we both labor under, determined not to get knocked flat. Smashing and smashing into each other, helmets blankly ringing to the whole team screaming in time to the drill. Timmy hit Tommy, Tommy hit Timmy, until, exhausted, we fall to our knees, and still coach refuses to blow the whistle so that we, on our knees, keep ramming into each other, implacable, servile, our hearts too violent not to play inside the rules. How we envied the hippies on the Joe Pyne show, Pyne sneering to Frank Zappa, so, I guess your long hair makes you a woman. Zappa shooting back, I guess your wooden leg makes you a table. White as calcium, white as moons brought down into swamp water, white as a cataract on a blind eye, the pads fuse on the shoulder bones to make us walk that athletic walk of power and glory and terror of shame. So Tommy hitting Timmy and Timmy hitting Tommy takes over mind and body in the zone until coach blows the whistle and we get up off our knees and turn to avoid each other's faces. Years later, brought down by gunflash insights of assassination and business frowns of gangbangers dividing up junk, while police held the line in riot masks and shields, I prayed for the cup to pass. But either way, I was an ass and had to carry my ass's load as far as an ass could. For a spacesuit set adrift, there's a very beautiful photograph on the NASA website of this spacesuit, which is where I came across it. There's the huge curve of the Earth, and basically the Russians on the space station got an old spacesuit, stuffed it full of old clothes, put a radio transmitter in it, shoved it out the airlock. And I just thought that was an amazing, oddly evocative image. So this is where I heard about it. Quote, NASA had reported that the SuitSat device, a Russian spacesuit equipped with a radio transmitter and stuffed with old clothes that would set adrift from the International Space Station, had ceased working within hours of its release on Friday. But a U.S. amateur radio spokesman said weak signals had been picked up. Death reports were premature, he said. BBC. Poems in four parts. Under the star flood, where the flood of Earth confronts her, tiny, unmoored, drifting upside down, the ocean's pupil peers into her helmet's faceplate. Voices hiss and crackle. Too late, your fault. It's not what she did, but what she did not do that haunts her. Ears ache with intonations, calling from dimensions beyond the three she knows, where the dead come and go, where absurd consolations talk inside her helmet. Who gave the order that made her take this walk past the corner comet, the next door asteroid? Why was she shoved out into this void? 2. Think of mayhem out in space, matter-hungry black holes that flay their stellar neighbors, fields of gravitation that crush matter to nearly nothing, galaxies colliding and eating one another. All of it going on in invisible bands of the spectrum, nobody at a funeral is aware of in the music. In the way the mourner leans over the coffin and strokes the wood. Marooned where nobody can reach her, her abandonment expanding like the decimals of pi, she senses the dead approaching, here. The dead that the ones down there glued to their antennae so desire and fear. They shove her out the airlock. They shove her out again. Again, the void fills her suit the way it fills the dark she floats in. 3. No way through, no way out but this. Or so say the ones that track her while Earth crackles with a plea, please, please, don't ever leave me. But voices of the dead decay into babble of the radio bubble, spreading ever wider and deeper into space. The split-second delay between when their mouths open and the sound reaches her ear takes the measure of her already changed position, as if all she needs to do is step out into the 10th dimension, where her old dresses and blouses come to life once more. But space curls and curves away. How she loathes infinity. She moves where the void moves her. 4. She dreams of the mothership. She dreams of gravity. She dreams space as her unbrokenness, her body touching everywhere. She's back before the Big Bang, before anyone can laugh at her, before her body can abandon her and love drifts away. She forgets past and future. She doesn't grow older or younger. No tears distort her eyes. Her ears are closed to everything. Every signal is decayed. All space compresses into her eyes. I'll read this poem for Greg. It's called To the Executive Director of the Fallen. The person in this poem, whenever I would meet him, we would talk about poetry for a while, and then we would part, and he would always say to me, "Don't let the monkeys stop typing." And at the end of the poem, talks about a Japanese no play. And in the no plays, at the very end of the play, a ghost comes out and dances its final passion. And the poem kind of takes off from, I was at a pond once where there were a bunch of little boys in the water, naked, and they were incredibly excited about a particular part of their anatomy, which they were just yelling at the top of their lungs how thrilled they were about it. And this reminded me a little bit of my friend. The little boy crying out, "Weenie, weenie," in self-panicking delight, waving his little cock under the banner of the sun, seemed pure Blake, all anarchy and energy, an innocence unfrightened of itself that shook the lake's waters and unsettled the strained composures and appointed certainties of whatever absolute speaker had been ranting in my brain. Peace through strength, justice must be ours. So many demon faces in the glass city. Each pubic triangle seemed, under the bathing suits, to grow electrical and crackle with a sexual shock that made me turn my face away. And who should be there but you, my dear Lord of Misrule, blowing smoke in all our faces, the clean bullet hole in your forehead above your self-ironic smile. Don't let the monkeys stop typing. And after I swam and I was sitting on the bank, after the boy and his parents had packed up and gone home, I played the no play over for you in the tape loop of the void where your voice and laughter so casually reside. How the mother, gone searching for her missing son, finds him dancing by the lake, and as she tries to hold him, he slips through her arms just as she slips through his arms. And as she cries out in perfect pitch, in perfect time, to the shrieking bamboo flute that her boy has drowned, she understands that she too has drowned, that she too is a ghost returning to dance as they dance together in a tighter and tighter round. I think I'll read some new poems. World Cup. I was in Lebanon when the World Cup was going on. In all the cafes on the seafront, whatever could be seen kept exploding in riots of blue, red, green. Horns everywhere hooting for the ball soaring toward the net. Slicks of trash and plastic glinting from the waves. The world was in a fever to see the perfect goal. The giant screens on every corner, loud with the locust thrum of satellite hookups. Between two limestone cliffs, I plunged into the filth, sucked a mouthful of oil, and set out swimming hard to where I heard rising voices shouting in Arabic, "Score! Score!" A big wave swept me under, another and another, until I shot out of the water that gleamed like a forehead budding mine, expert but without malice, threatening to drag me down until I slid out on the rocks. I shivered and wanted to live in the clear light of the announcer's voices, echoing in different languages, weaving a net so fine the sun could pass through it. Yet you could see in instant replay the ball caught and caught and caught, and not one stitch of that fabric going taut. This poem is called KM4. It's in 9 parts. They're short, don't worry. All of them are much less than a page. KM4 is a marker in Mogadishu, where I was about a year ago. The mouth, not English, Somali, Italian, French. The mouth blown open in the Toyota battle wagon at KM4 speaks in a language never heard before. Not the absolute speaker of the news, not crisis, chatters, famine, flame. The mouth blown open at KM4 speaks in a language never heard before. Speaks back to the dead at KM4, old men in jilbabs, beards dyed with henna, the women wearing blue jeans under black chadors. Nothing solved or resolved, exactly as they were. The old wars still flickering and the auras round their faces. The mouth of smoke at KM4, mouth syllables of smoke never heard before. The concert. Lake water in smooth, still sun moves in and out of sync with a violin playing at the villa. The bow attacking the strings looks like a hand making some frantic motion to come closer, go away. It's hard to say what's being said, who's being summoned from the dead, from red sand drifting across the sheen of the shining floor. The pianist's hands taking wing to hover above a chord become the flight path of a Marabou stork crashing down on carrion. The piano levitating up and up above red sand that it starts to float across, the way a camel's humps far off in the mirage rise and fall, fall and rise, until mirage overbrims itself and everything into its shimmering disappears. And the ones who died the day before, blown up at the crossroads at KM4, scanning the notice board for scholarship results, put their fingers to their names as the onlookers applaud. Oracle. The little man carved out of bone shout something to the world can't hear. All around him, the roads, lost and drifted deep red sand, die out in sun, just clearing the plain. Dried out, faded, he makes an invocation at an altar. An AK-47 stood up on its butt end in a pile of rock. The AK talks the talk, of what guns talk, not rage or death or cliches of killing, but specifics of what it means to be fired off in the air. No fear when it jams, no enemy running away, no feeling like a river overflowing in a cloudburst. Forget all that. The little man of bone is not the streaming head of the river god roaring at Achilles, nor dead Patroclus complaining in a dream how Achilles has forgotten him. The AK wants to tell a different truth, a truth ungarbled, that is so obvious, no one could possibly mistake its meaning. If you look down the cyclops' eye of the barrel, what you'll see is a boy with trousers rolled above his ankles. You'll see a mouth of bone moving in syllables that have the rapid-fire clarity of a weapon that can fire 600 rounds a minute. Four. Before he blew himself up, he liked to play at games with other youths. And there, among the dead, appearing beside your tent flap, at your elbow in the mess hall, waiting to use or just leaving the showers and latrine, the boy with his trousers rolled appears like an after image burned into an antique computer screen, haunting whatever the cursor tries to track. So he liked to play at games with other youths. The English has a slightly too formal sound of someone being poured through the sieve of another language. Syllable after syllable piling up and up until the boy, buried to the neck, slowly vanishes into overtones that are and are not his, as if he were a solid, melting to liquid, turning to gas, feeding a flame. Time to forget. There's a camel, a goat, a sandal, left in red sand. Over there's a water tower, under that's the borehole, and here the body asks and asks about the role it's asked to play. No matter how it's dressed, like a nomad, like a journalist, like the hyena who eats even the bones and shits bone-white scat from the calcium. No matter if it sleeps under a dome of UNHCR plastic, baby blue in the sun, or hides in a spider hole, or walks around in uniform behind plate glass, the body makes itself known before it becomes unknown. On the television, the Blade Runner is facing down the skin job, and of the two, who is the more human? On the table, there isn't a glass of whiskey, but the ghost of whiskey that keeps whispering it's okay to be this way. Nobody will know. And then the boy who rolls his pant legs up above his ankles because to let them drag along the ground is to be unclean, turns right before your eyes into a skeleton. The coming. At KM4, a wall of leaves spits green into the air and hangs there, beautiful and repulsive. Between the leaves and the interstices where birds don't stir in sun and heat, the smell of raw camel meat wakes you to the vision of what keeps going on in the wound. The wound inside your head that you more or less shut out as you go round and round the roundabout at KM4, where your friends, the soldiers, and the Caspier are all pretending to be dead. The TV Ken doll anchor keeps complaining to their corpses, "Hey, can't you get my flak jacket adjusted so it doesn't crush my collar?" Leaves softly undulating, little waves of leaves undergoing shifts between astral blue and green, leaves always breaking on leaves, and the little breeze that the Caspier passing stirs in the heat, stirring the memory of putting your fingers in the wounds of a blast wall at KM4, as if you were Doubting Thomas, waiting for Christ to appear. Thumb-sized holes for AK-47s, fist size for 20 caliber, both fists for 50. At court. Off behind the acacias, in a little oasis of galvanized shade, the soldiers sit smoking and joking. They talk to you with shy smiles and gentle laughter. They offer cigarettes before you can offer them. Their tact and manners are exquisite. It's like being at a king's court where the thrones are three-legged stools, where the knights before battle go around in regulation issue sleeveless undershirts, where the gold and silver floor is dust packed hard by boots. Now the wind is blowing through the trees. The scene is changing as the day moon grows strong. Leaves hanging from the branches drip and curdle in the afternoon sun. The soldiers lie down on mats, their faces slacken. Sleep runs like a hand over their skinny bodies, and a goat climbs into a huge cooking pot and licks and licks the sides clean. Reunion. The journalist who doesn't sleep walks into a bullet. The young boy with trousers rolled waits at KM4. Before them both is a door into the earth that swings back like a cellar door in the last century. Ahmed, Abdi, Ali, Patrice, Andy, Bill, Rika, Zero, Edel, Yoko, meet in the underworld at the Grease Pit Bar and talk about rotations up to the world of the living. They come back like Patroclus to accuse dreaming Achilles of having forgotten and forsaken him, faithless in death to their companions. The sun, compressed to a sliver, shines through the mesh of my mosquito net that holds back mosquitoes hovering like the souls I don't believe in, of those who've died or have gone missing in the wind's unsubtle devastations. But the love of lost companions brings back wet underwear. Socks, t-shirts, boxer shorts, bras, panties, a dhoti hung from thorn trees to dry in the dawn breeze. Too late. Here the body is the sheared off wing of the Transavia plane, lying in a scrap heap like the knocked off arm of an old Grecian figurine of winged victory pacing down the deck of Athenian might. Here, you can let yourself go in so many ways. The bomb pack strapped to your waist and detonated by pushing send on your cell phone. Or the eternal aesthete in his eternal pursuit of just the right moment to see the splintering of light passing through tent mesh, waking you to the unambivalent hate you've always craved. The rivals walk off to where the broken pediments of the cathedral still brace under the weight of the rose window. And the body barters for the ghosts pinned down by the shadows, passing over the ocean's dry whispering of waves, telling the body it's too late. It's always been too late to come rising at this moment from the grave. Thank you very much.